Day 83. Loaded and moving before dawn today. The air smells of smoke and ashes. The change in vegetation here on the plateau is startling. No longer evident are the ubiquitous werewood and leafy chalma. After passing through an intermediate zone of short evergreens and everblues, then after climbing again through dense strands of mutated lodgepole pines and triaspen, we came into the flame forest proper, with its groves of tall Prometheus, trailers of ever-present phoenix, and round stands of amber lambents. Occasionally, we encountered impenetrable breaks of the white fibrous, bifurcated bestos plants that Tuck picturesquely referred to as looking like the rotting cocks of some dead giants, what be buried shallow here, that be sure. My guide has a way with words. It was late afternoon before we saw our first Tesla tree. For half an hour we had been trudging over an ash-covered forest floor, trying not to tread on the tender shoots of phoenix and firewhip, gamely pushing up through the sooty soil, when suddenly Tuck stopped and pointed. The Tesla tree, still half a kilometer away, stood at least 100 meters tall, half again as high as the tallest Prometheus. Near its crown it bulged with the distinctive onion-shaped dome of its accumulator gall. The radial branches above the gall trailed dozens of nimbus vines, each looking silver and metallic against the clear green and lapis sky. The whole thing made me think of some elegant, high Muslim mosque on New Mecca, irreverently garlanded with tinsel.
"We got to get the brids and our asses the hell out of here," grunted Tuck.
He insisted that we change into flame forest gear right then and there. We spent the rest of the afternoon and evening trudging on in our osmosis masks and thick, rubber-soled boots, sweating under layers of leathery gamma cloth. Both of the brids acted nervous, their long ears pricking at the slightest sound. Even through my mask I could smell the ozone. It reminded me of electric trains I had played with as a child, on lazy Christmas Day afternoons in Villefranche-sur-Saône. We are camping as close as we can to a bestos break this night. Tuck showed me how to set out the ring of arrestor rods, all the time clucking dire warnings to himself and searching the evening sky for clouds. I plan to sleep well in spite of everything. Day 84. Oh, 400 hours. Sweet Mother of Christ! For 3 hours we have been caught up in the middle of the end of the world. The explosion started shortly after midnight, mere lightning crashes at first, and against our better judgment, Tuck and I slid our heads through the tent flap to watch the pyrotechnics. I am used to the Matthew month monsoon storms on Pachim, so the first hour of lightning displays did not seem too unusual. Only the sight of distant Tesla trees as the unerring focus of the aerial discharge was a bit unnerving. But soon the forest behemoths were glowing and spitting with their own accumulated energy, and then, just as I was drifting off to sleep despite the continued noise, true Armageddon was unleashed. At least 100 arcs of electricity must have been released in the first 10 seconds of the Tesla tree's opening spasms of violent energy. A Prometheus, less than 30 meters from us, exploded, dropping flaming brands 50 meters to the forest floor. The arrestor rods glowed, hissed, and deflected arc after arc of blue-white death over and around our small campsite. Tuck screamed something, but no mere human sound was audible over the onslaught of light and noise. A patch of trailing phoenix burst into flame near the tethered brids, and one of the terrified animals, hobbled and blindfolded as it was, broke free and lunged through the circle of glowing arrestor rods. Instantly, half a dozen bolts of lightning from the nearest Tesla arced to the hapless animal. For a mad second, I could have sworn I saw the beast's skeleton glowing through boiling flesh, and then it spasmed high into the air and simply ceased to be. For 3 hours we have watched the end of the world.
Two of the arrestor rods have fallen, but the other eight continue to function. Tuck and I huddle in the hot cave of our tent, osmosis masks filtering enough cool oxygen out of the superheated, smoky air to allow us to breathe. Only the lack of undergrowth and Tuck's skill in placing our tent away from other targets and near the sheltering Bestos plants have allowed us to survive. That, and the eight whiskered alloy rods that stand between us and eternity. "They seem to be holding up well," I shout to Tuck over the hiss and crackle, crash and split of the storm.
"Dey be made to stand a hour, maybe two,"
grunts my guide.
"Any time, maybe sooner, dey fuse, we die."
I nod and sip at lukewarm water through the slipstrip of my osmosis mask. If I survive this night, I shall always thank God for his generosity in allowing me to see this sight. Day 87. Tuck and I emerged from the smoldering northeastern edge of the flame forest at noon yesterday. Promptly set up camp by the edge of a small stream and slept for 18 hours straight, making up for 3 nights of no sleep and 2 grueling days moving without rest through a nightmare of flame and ash. Everywhere we looked as we approached the hogback ridge that marked the terminus of the forest, we could see seed pods and cones burst open with new life for the various fire species that had died in the conflagration of the previous 2 nights. 5 of our arrestor rods still functioned, although neither Tuck nor I was eager to test them another night. Our surviving packbred collapsed and died the instant the heavy load was lifted off its back. I awoke this morning at dawn to the sound of running water. I followed the small stream a kilometer to the northeast, following a deepening in its sound, until suddenly it dropped from sight. The cleft. I had almost forgotten our destination. This morning, stumbling through the fog, leaping from one wet rock to another alongside the widening stream, I took a leap to a final boulder, teetered there, regained my balance, and looked straight down above a waterfall that dropped almost 3,000 meters to mist, rock, and river far below. The cleft was not carved out of the rising plateau, as was the legendary Grand Canyon on Old Earth, or World Crack on Hebron. In spite of its active oceans and seemingly Earth-like continents, Hyperion is tectonically quite dead. More like Mars, Lussis, or Armagast in its total lack of continental drift. And like Mars and Lussis, Hyperion is afflicted with its deep ice ages. Although here the periodicity is spread to 37 million years by the long ellipse of the currently absent binary dwarf. The comlog compares the cleft to the pre-terraformed Mariner Valley on Mars, both being caused by the weakening of crust through periodic freeze and thaw over the eons, followed by the flow of subterranean rivers such as the Khans. Then the massive collapse, running like a long scar through the mountainous wing of the continent Aquila. Tuck joined me as I stood on the edge of the cleft. I was naked, rinsing the ash smell from my traveling clothes and cassock. I splashed cold water over my pale flesh and laughed out loud as the echo of Tuck's shouts came back from the north wall, 2/3 of a kilometer away. Because of the nature of the crust collapse, Tuck and I stood far out on an overhang that hid the south wall below us. Although perilously exposed, we assumed that the rocky cornice which had defied gravity for millions of years would last a few more hours, as we bathed, relaxed, shouted echoing hellos until we were hoarse, and generally acted like children liberated from school. Tuck confessed that he had never penetrated the full width of the flame forest, nor known anyone who had in this season, and announced that, now that the Tesla trees were becoming fully active, he would have at least a 3-month wait until he could return. He did not seem too sorry, and I was glad to have him with me. In the afternoon, We transported my gear in relays, setting up camp near the stream 100 meters back from the cornice, and stacking my flow foam boxes of scientific gear for further sorting in the morning. It was cold this evening. After dinner, just before sunset, I pulled on my thermal jacket and walked alone to a rocky ledge southwest of where I had first encountered the cleft. From my vantage point, far out over the river, the view was memorable. Mists rose from unseen waterfalls, tumbling to the river far below. Spray rising and shifting curtains of mist to multiply the setting sun into a dozen violet spheres and twice that many rainbows. I watched as each spectrum was born, rose toward the darkening dome of sky and died. As the cooling air settled into the cracks and caverns of the plateau, and the warm air rushed skyward, pulling leaves, twigs, and mist upward in a vertical gale, a sound ebbed up out of the cleft, as if the continent itself was calling with the voices of stone giants, gigantic bamboo flutes, church organs the size of palaces. The clear, perfect notes ranging from the shrillest soprano to the deepest bass. I speculated on wind vectors against the fluted rock walls, on caverns far below, venting deep cracks in the motionless crust, and on the illusion of human voices that random harmonics can generate. But in the end, I set aside speculation, and simply listened as the cleft sang its farewell hymn to the sun. I walked back to our tent, and its circle of bioluminescent lantern light, as the first fusillade of meteor showers burned the skies overhead, and distant explosions from the flame forests rippled along the southern and western horizons, like cannon fire from some ancient war on pre-Hegira old earth. Once in the tent, I tried the long-range comlog bands, but there is nothing but static. I suspect that even if the primitive commsats that serve the fiberplastic plantations were ever to broadcast this far east, anything but the tightest laser or fatline beams would be masked by the mountains and Tesla activity. On Pacham, few of us at the monastery wore or carried personal comlogs, but the datasphere was always there if we needed to tap into it. Here there is no choice. I sit and listen to the last notes from the canyon wind die, watch the skies simultaneously darken and blaze, smile at the sound of Tuck snoring from his bedroll outside the tent, and I think to myself, if this is exile, so be it. Day 88. Tuck is dead. Murdered. I found his body when I left the tent at sunrise. He had been sleeping outside, not more than 4 meters from me. He had said that he wished to sleep under the stars. The murderers cut his throat while he slept. I heard no cry. I did dream, however. Dreams of Sempha ministering to me during my fever. Dreams of cool hands touching my neck and chest, touching the crucifix I have worn since childhood. I stood over Tuck's body, staring at the wide, dark circle where his blood had soaked into Hyperion's uncaring soil, and I shivered at the thought that the dream had been more than a dream, that hands had touched me in the night. I confess that I reacted more like a frightened old fool than as a priest. I did administer extreme unction, but then the panic struck me, and I left my poor guide's body, desperately searched through the supplies for a weapon, and took away the machete I had used in the rainforest, and the low-voltage maser with which I had planned to hunt small game. Whether I would have used a weapon on a human being, even to save my own life, I do not know. But in my panic I carried the machete, the maser, and the powered binoculars to a high boulder near the cleft and searched the region for any sign of the murderers. Nothing stirred, except the tiny arboreals and gossamers we had seen flitting through the trees yesterday. The forest itself seemed abnormally thick and dark. The cleft offered 100 terraces, ledges, and rock balconies to the northeast for entire bands of savages. An army could have hidden there in the crags and ever-present mists. After 30 minutes of fruitless vigilance and foolish cowardice, I returned to the campsite and prepared Tuck's body for burial. It took me well over 2 hours to dig a proper grave in the rocky soil of the plateau. When it was filled and the formal service was finished, I could think of nothing personal to say about the rough, funny little man who had been my guide. "Watch over him, Lord," I said at last, disgusted at my own hypocrisy, sure in my heart that I was mouthing words only to myself. "Give him safe passage. Amen." This evening I have moved my camp 0.5 kilometer north. My tent is pitched in an open area 10 meters away, but I am wedged with my back against the boulder, sleeping robes pulled around, the machete and mazer nearby. After Tuck's funeral, I went through the supplies and boxes of equipment. Nothing had been taken, except for the few remaining arrestor rods. Immediately I wondered if someone had followed us through the flame forest in order to kill Tuck and strand me here, but I could think of no motive for such an elaborate action. Anyone from the plantations could have killed us as we slept in the rainforest, or, better yet from a murderer's point of view, deep in the flame forest, where no one would wonder at 2 charred corpses. That left the Bikura, my primitive charges. I considered returning through the flame forest without the rods, but soon abandoned the idea. It is probable death to stay, and certain death to go. 3 months before the Teslas become dormant. 120 of the 26-hour local days. An eternity. Dear Christ, why has this come to me? And why was I spared last night if I am merely to be offered up this night, or next? I sit here in the darkening crag, and I listen to the suddenly ominous moaning rising with the night wind from the cleft, and I pray, as the sky lights with the blood-red streaks of meteor trails, mouthing words to myself. Day 95. The terrors of the past week have largely abated. I find that even fear fades and becomes commonplace after days of anticlimax. I use the machete to cut small trees for a lean-to, covering the roof and side with gamma cloth and caulking between the logs with mud. The back wall is the solid stone of the boulder. I have sorted through my research gear and set some of it out, although I suspect that I will never use it now. I have begun foraging to supplement my quickly diminishing cache of freeze-dried food. By now, according to the absurd schedule drawn up so long ago on Pacham, I was to have been living with the Bikura for some weeks and trading small goods for local food. No matter. Besides my diet of bland but easily boiled chalma roots, I have found 6 varieties of berries and larger fruits that the comlog assures me are edible. So far, only one has disagreed with me enough to keep me squatting all night near the edge of the nearest ravine. I pace the confines of the region as restlessly as one of those caged pelops that were so prized by the minor padishahs on Armagast. 1 kilometer to the south and 4 to the west, the flame forests are in full form. In the morning, smoke vies with the shifting curtains of mist to hide the sky. Only the near solid breaks of Bestos, the rocky soil here on the summit plateau, and the hogback ridges running like armor-plated vertebrae northeast from here keep the Teslas at bay. To the north. The plateau widens out, and the undergrowth becomes denser near the cleft for some 15 kilometers, until the way is blocked by a ravine a third as deep and half as wide as the cleft itself. Yesterday, I reached this northernmost point and stared across the gaping barrier with some frustration. I will try again some day, detouring to the east to find a crossing point. But from the telltale signs of Phoenix across the chasm, and the pall of smoke along the northeastern horizon, I suspect I will find only the Chalma-filled canyons and steppes of flame forest that are roughed in on the orbital survey map I carry. Tonight, I visited Tuck's rocky grave as the evening wind began to wail its aeolian dirge. I knelt there and tried to pray, but nothing came. Edward, nothing came. I am as empty as those fake sarcophagi that you and I unearthed by the score from the sterile desert sands near Tarim Belwadi. The Zen Gnostics would say that this emptiness is a good sign, that it presages openness to a new level of awareness, new insights, new experience. Merde. My emptiness is only emptiness. Day 96. I have found the Bikura. Or rather, they have found me. I will write what I can before they come to rouse me from my sleep. Today I was doing some detail mapping a mere 4 kilometers north of camp, when the mists lifted in the midday warmth, and I noticed a series of terraces on my side of the cleft that had been hidden until then. I was using my powered glasses to inspect the terraces, actually a series of laddered ledges, spires, shelves, and tussocks extending far out onto the overhang, when I realized that I was staring at man-made habitations. The dozen or so huts were crude, rough hovels of heaped chalma fronds, stones, and sponge turf, but they were unmistakably of human origin. I was standing there, irresolute, binoculars still lifted, trying to decide whether to climb down to the exposed ledges and confront the inhabitants or to retreat to my camp, when I felt that lifting chill along the back and neck that tells one with absolute certainty that he is no longer alone. I lowered the binoculars and turned slowly. The Bikura were there, at least 30 of them, standing in a semicircle that left me no retreat to the forest. I do not know what I expected. Naked savages, perhaps, with fierce expressions and necklaces of teeth. Perhaps I had half expected to find the kind of bearded, wild-haired hermits that travelers sometimes encountered in the Moshe Mountains on Hebron. Whatever I had held in mind, the reality of the Bikura did not fit the template. The people who had approached me so silently were short. None came higher than my shoulder, and swathed in roughly woven dark robes that covered them from neck to toe. When they moved, as some did now, they seemed to glide over the rough ground like wraiths. From a distance, their appearance reminded me of nothing so much as a gaggle of diminutive Jesuits at a new Vatican enclave. I almost giggled then, but realized that such a response might well be a sign of rising panic. The Bikura showed no outward signs of aggression to cause such a panic. They carried no weapons, their small hands were empty as their expressions. Their physiognomy is hard to describe succinctly. They are bald, all of them. That baldness, the absence of any facial hair, and the loose robes that fell in a straight line to the ground, all conspired to make it very difficult to tell the men from the women. The group now confronting me, more than 50 by this time, looked to be all of roughly the same age, somewhere between 40 and 50 standard years. Their faces were smooth, the skin tinged with a yellowish cast that I guessed might be associated with generations of ingesting trace minerals in the Chalma and other local plant life. One might be tempted to describe the round faces of the Bikura as cherubic until, upon closer inspection, that impression of sweetness fades and is replaced by another interpretation. Placid idiocy. As a priest, I have spent enough time on backward worlds to see the effects of an ancient genetic disorder, variously called Down syndrome, Mongolism, or generation ship legacy. This, then, was the overall impression created by the 60 or so dark-robed little people who had approached me. I was being greeted by a silent, smiling band of bald, retarded children. I reminded myself that these were almost certainly the same group of smiling children who had slit Tuck's throat while he slept and left him to die like a butchered pig. The closest Bikura stepped forward, stopped 5 paces from me, and said something in a soft monotone. "Just a minute," I said, and fumbled out my comm log. I tapped in the translator function.
"Beetet otamena lot kresfemket?"
asked the short man in front of me. I slipped on the hear plug just in time to hear the comm log's translation. There was no lag time. The apparently foreign language was a simple corruption of archaic seedship English, not so far removed from the indigene argot of the plantations.
"You are the man who belongs to the cross-shaped cruciform?"
interpreted the comm log, giving me 2 choices for the final noun. "Yes," I said, knowing now that these were the ones who had touched me the night I slept through Tuck's murder, which meant that these were the ones who had murdered Tuck. I waited. The hunting mazer was in my pack. The pack was set against a small chalma, not 10 paces from me. Half a dozen Bikura stood between me and it. It did not matter. I knew at that instant that I would not use a weapon against another human being, even a human being who had murdered my guide and might well be planning to murder me at any second. I closed my eyes and said a silent act of contrition. When I opened my eyes, more of the Bikura had arrived. There was a cessation of movement, as if a quorum had been filled, a decision reached. "Yes," I said again into the silence. "I am the one who wears the cross." I heard the comm log speaker pronounce the last word, "Kresfem." The Bikura nodded in unison and, as if from long practice as altar boys, all went to one knee, robes rustling softly in a perfect genuflection. I opened my mouth to speak and found that I had nothing to say. I closed my mouth. The Bikura stood, a breeze moved the brittle chalma fronds and leaves together to make a dry, end-of-summer sound above us. The Bikura nearest to me on the left stepped closer, grasped my forearm with a touch of cool, strong fingers, and spoke a soft sentence that my comm log translated as, "Come, it is time to go to the houses and sleep." It was mid-afternoon. Wondering if the comm log had translated the word sleep properly, or if it might be an idiom or metaphor for die, I nodded and followed them toward the village at the edge of the cleft. Now I sit in the hut and wait. There are rustling sounds. Someone else is awake now. I sit and wait.
Day 97. The Bikura call themselves the 70. I have spent the past 26 hours talking to them, observing, making notes when they take their 2-hour, mid-afternoon sleep, and generally trying to record as much data as I can before they decide to slit my throat. Except now I am beginning to believe that they will not hurt me. I spoke to them yesterday after our sleep. Sometimes they do not respond to questions, and when they do, the responses are little better than the grunts or divergent answers one receives from slow children. After their initial question and invitation at our first encounter, none of them originated a single query or comment my way.
I questioned them subtly, carefully, cautiously, and with the professional calm of a trained ethnologist. I asked the simplest, most factual questions possible to make sure that the comm log was functioning properly. It was. But the sum total of the answers left me almost as ignorant as I had been 20-some hours before. Finally, tired in body and spirit, I abandoned professional subtlety and asked the group I was sitting with, "Did you kill my companion?" My three interlocutors did not look up from the weaving they were doing on a crude loom. "Yes," said the one I have come to think of as Alpha, because he had been the first to approach me in the forest. "We cut your companion's throat with sharpened stones and held him down and silent while he struggled. He died the true death." "Why?" I asked, after a moment. My voice sounded as dry as a corn husk crumbling. "Why did he die the true death?" said Alpha, still not looking up. "Because all of his blood ran out and he stopped breathing." "No," I said. "Why did you kill him?" Alpha did not respond, but Betty, who may or may not be female and Alpha's mate, looked up from her loom and said simply, "To make him die." "Why?" The responses invariably came back and just as invariably failed to enlighten me one iota. After much questioning, I had ascertained that they had killed Tuck to make him die, and that he had died because he had been killed. "What is the difference between death and true death?" I asked, not trusting the comm log or my temper at this point. The third Bikura, Del, grunted a response that the comm log interpreted as, "Your companion died the true death. You did not." Finally, in frustration far too close to rage, I snapped, "Why not? Why didn't you kill me?" All three stopped in the middle of their mindless weaving and looked at me. "You cannot be killed, because you cannot die," said Alpha. "You cannot die because you belong to the cruciform and follow the way of the cross." I had no idea why the damn machine would translate cross as cross one second, and as cruciform the next. "Because you belong to the cruciform." A chill went through me, followed by the urge to laugh. Had I stumbled into that old adventure hollow cliché, the lost tribe that worshipped the god that had tumbled into their jungle, until the poor bastard cuts himself shaving or something, and the tribe's people, assured and a bit relieved at the obvious mortality of their visitor, offer up their erstwhile deity as a sacrifice? It would have been funny if the image of Tuck's bloodless face and raw-rimmed, gaping wound was not so fresh. Their reaction to the cross certainly suggested that I had encountered a group of survivors of a once Christian colony. Catholics? Even though the data in the comm log insisted that the dropship of 70 colonists who had crashed on this plateau 400 years ago had held only neo-Kirwin Marxists, all of whom should have been indifferent, if not openly hostile to the old religions. I considered dropping the matter as being far too dangerous to pursue, but my stupid need to know drove me on. "Do you worship Jesus?" I asked. Their blank expressions left no need for a verbal negative. "Christ?" I tried again. "Jesus Christ? Christian? The Catholic Church?" No interest. "Catholic. Jesus, Mary, St. Peter, Paul, St. Tear." The comm log made noises, but the words seemed to have no meaning for them. "You follow the cross," I said, flailing for some last contact. All three looked at me. "We belong to the cruciform," said Alpha. I nodded, understanding nothing. This evening I fell asleep briefly just before sunset. and when I awoke it was to the organ-pipe music of the cleft's nightfall winds. It was much louder here on the village ledges. Even the hovels seemed to join the chorus as the rising gusts whistled and whined through stone gaps, flapping fronds and crude smoke holes. Something was wrong. It took me a groggy minute to realize that the village was abandoned. Every hut was empty. I sat on a cold boulder and wondered if my presence had sparked some mass exodus. The wind music had ended, and meteors were beginning their nightly show through cracks in low clouds when I heard a sound behind me and turned to find all 70 of the 70 behind me. They walked past without a word and went to their huts. There were no lights. I imagined them sitting in their hovels, staring. I stayed outside for some time before returning to my own hut. After a while, I walked to the edge of the grassy shelf and stood where rock dropped away into the abyss. A cluster of vines and roots clung to the cliff face, but appeared to end a few meters into space and hang there above emptiness. No vine could have been long enough to offer a way to the river 2 kilometers below. But the Bikura had come from this direction. Nothing made sense. I shook my head and went back to my hut. Sitting here, writing by the light of the comm log disk key, I try to think of precautions I can take to ensure that I will see the sunrise. I can think of none. Day 103. The more I learn, the less I understand. I have moved most of my gear to the hut they leave empty for me here in the village. I have taken photographs, recorded video and audio chips, and imaged a full holo scan of the village and its inhabitants. They do not seem to care. I project their images and they walk right through them, showing no interest. I play back their words to them, and they smile and go back into their hovels to sit for hours, doing nothing, saying nothing. I offer them trade trinkets, and they take them without comment, check to see if they are edible, and then leave them lying. The grass is littered with plastic beads, mirrors, bits of colored cloth, and cheap pens. I have set up the full medical lab, but to no avail. The 70 will not let me examine them, will not let me take blood samples, even though I have repeatedly shown them that it is painless. Will not let me scan them with the diagnostic equipment, will not, in short, cooperate in any way. They do not argue. They do not explain. They simply turn away and go about their non-business. After a week, I still cannot tell the males from the females. Their faces remind me of those visual puzzles that shift forms as you stare. Sometimes Betty's face looks undeniably female, and 10 seconds later, the sense of gender is gone and I think of her, him, as Beta again. Their voices undergo the same shift. Soft, well-modulated, sexless. They remind me of the poorly programmed home comps one encounters on backward worlds. I find myself hoping to catch a glimpse of a naked Bikura. This is not easy for a Jesuit of 48 standard years to admit. Still, it would not be an easy task even for a veteran voyeur. The nudity taboo seems absolute. They wear the long robes while awake and during their 2-hour midday nap. They leave the village area to urinate and defecate, and I suspect that they do not remove the loose robes even then. They do not seem to bathe. One would suspect that this would cause olfactory problems, but there is no odor about these primitives except for the slight, sweet smell of chalma. "You must undress sometimes," I said to Alpha one day, abandoning delicacy in favor of information. "No," said Al, and went elsewhere to sit and do nothing while fully dressed. They have no names. I found this incredible at first, but now I am sure.
"We are all that was and will be," said the shortest Bikura, one I think of as female and call Epi. We are the 70.
I searched the comlog records and confirmed what I suspected. In more than 16,000 known human societies, none are listed where there are no individual names at all. Even in the Lussis hive societies, individuals respond to their class category followed by a simple code. I tell them my name and they stare. Father Paul Dure. Father Paul Dure, repeats the comlog translator, but there is no attempt at even simple repetition. Except for their mass disappearances each day before sunset, and their common 2-hour sleep time, they do very little as a group. Even their lodging arrangements appear random. Al will spend one nap time with Betty, the next with Gam, and the third with Zelda or Pete. No system or schedule is apparent. Every third day, the entire group of 70 goes into the forest to forage and returns with berries, chalma roots and bark, fruit, and whatever else might be edible. I was sure they were vegetarians until I saw Del munching on the cold corpse of an infant arboreal. The little primate must have fallen from the high branches. It seems, then, that the 70 do not disdain meat. They simply are too stupid to hunt and kill it. When the Bikura are thirsty, they walk almost 300 meters to a stream that cascades into the cleft. In spite of this inconvenience, there are no signs of water skins, jugs, or any type of pottery. I keep my reserve of water in 10-gallon plastic containers, but the villagers take no notice. In my plummeting respect for these people, I do not find it unlikely that they have spent generations in a village with no handy water source. "Who built the houses?" I ask. They have no word for village.
"The 70, responds Will.
I can tell him from the others only by a broken finger that did not mend well. Each of them has at least one such distinguishing feature, although sometimes I think it would be easier to tell crows apart. "When did they build them?" I ask, although I should know by now that any question that starts with "when" will not receive an answer. I receive no answer. They do go into the cleft each evening, down the vines. On the third evening, I tried to observe this exodus, but 6 of them turned me back from the edge and gently but persistently brought me back to my hut. It was the first observable action of the Bikura that had hinted at aggression, and I sat in some apprehension after they had gone. The next evening as they departed, I went quietly to my hut, not even peering out. But after they returned, I retrieved the imager and its tripod from where I had left them near the edge. The timer had worked perfectly. The hollows showed the Bikura grabbing the vines and scrambling down the cliff face as nimbly as the little arboreals that fill the chalma and werewood forests. Then they disappeared under the overhang. "What do you do when you go down the cliff each evening?" I asked Al the next day. The native looked at me with the seraphic Buddha smile I have learned to hate. "You belong to the cruciform," he said, as if that answered everything. "Do you worship when you go down the cliff?" I asked. No answer. I thought a minute. "I also follow the cross," I said, knowing that it would be translated as "belong to the cruciform." Any day now I will not need the translator program, but this conversation was too important to leave to chance. "Does this mean that I should join you when you go down the cliff face?" For a second I thought that Al was thinking. His brow furrowed, and I realized that it was the first time that I had seen one of the 70 come close to frowning. Then he said, "You cannot. You belong to the cruciform, but you are not of the 70. I realized that it had taken every neuron and synapse in his brain to frame that distinction.
"What would you do if I did go down the cliff face?" I asked, expecting no response. Hypothetical questions almost always had as much luck as my time-based queries. This time he did respond. The seraphic smile and untroubled countenance returned, and Alpha said softly, "If you try to go down the cliff, we will hold you down on the grass, take sharpened stones, cut your throat, and wait until your blood stops flowing and your heart stops beating." I said nothing. I wondered if he could hear the pounding of my heart at that moment. "Well," I thought, "at least you don't have to worry any longer that they think you are a god." The silence stretched. Finally, Al added one more sentence that I have been thinking about ever since. "And if you did it again," he said, "we would have to kill you again." We stared at each other for some time after that, each convinced, I am sure, that the other was a total idiot. Day 104. Each new revelation adds to my confusion. The absence of children here has bothered me since my first day in the village. Looking back through my notes, I find frequent mention of it in the daily observations I have dictated to my comm log, but no record of it in the personal mishmash here that I call a journal. Perhaps the implications were too frightening. To my frequent and clumsy attempts at piercing this mystery, the 60 and 10 have offered their usual enlightenment. The person questioned smiles beatifically, and responds in some non sequitur that would make the babble of the web's worst village idiot seem like sage aphorisms in comparison. More often than not, they do not answer at all. One day I stood in front of the one I have tagged as Dell, stayed there until he had to acknowledge my presence and asked, "Why are there no children?" "We are the 60 and 10, he said softly. "Where are the babies?" No response. No sense of evading the question, merely a blank stare. I took a breath. "Who is the youngest among you?" Dell appeared to be thinking, wrestling with the concept. He was overmatched. I wondered if the Bikura had lost their time sense so completely that any such question was doomed. After a minute of silence, however, Dell pointed to where Al was crouched in the sunlight, working with his crude hand loom, and said, "There is the last one to return." "To return?" I said. "From where?" Dell stared at me with no emotion, not even impatience. "You belong to the cruciform," he said. "You must know the way of the cross." I nodded. I knew enough to recognize that in this direction lay one of the many conversational, illogic loops that usually derailed our dialogues. I hunted for some way to keep a grasp of the thin thread of information. "Then Al," I said and pointed, "is the last to be born, to return. But others will." "Return?" I was not sure that I understood my own question. How does one inquire about birth when the interviewee has no word for child and no concept of time? But Dell seemed to understand. He nodded. Encouraged, I asked, "Then when will the next of the 60 and 10 be born? Return?"
"No one can return until one dies," he said.
Suddenly, I thought I understood. "So, no new children. No one will be returned until someone dies," I said. "You replace the missing one with another to keep the group at 60 and 10. Dell responded with the type of silence I had come to interpret as assent. The pattern seemed clear enough. The Bikura were quite serious about their 60 and 10. They kept the tribal population at 70. the same number recorded on the passenger list of the dropship that crashed here 400 years ago. Little chance of coincidence there. When someone died, they allowed a child to be born to replace the adult. Simple. Simple but impossible. Nature and biology do not work that neatly. Besides the problem of minimum herd population, there were other absurdities. Even though it is difficult to tell the ages of these smooth-skinned people, it is obvious that no more than 10 years separates the oldest from the youngest. Although they act like children, I would guess their average age to be in the late 30s or mid-40s in standard years. So where are the very old? Where are the parents, aging uncles, and unmarried aunts? At this rate, the entire tribe will enter old age at approximately the same time. What happens when they all pass beyond childbearing age and it comes time to replace members of the tribe? The Bakura lead dull, sedentary lives. The accident rate, even while living on the very edge of the cleft, must be low. There are no predators. The seasonal variations are minimal, and the food supply almost certainly remains stable. But granted all this, there must have been times in the 400-year history of this baffling group when disease swept the village, when more than the usual number of vines gave way and dropped citizens into the cleft, or when something caused that abnormal cluster of sudden deaths that insurance companies have dreaded since time immemorial. And then what? Do they breed to make up the difference and then revert to their current sexless behavior? Are the Bakura so different from every other recorded human society that they have a rutting period once every few years? Once a decade? Once in a lifetime? It is doubtful. I sit here in my hut and review the possibilities. One is that these people live very long lifetimes and can reproduce during most of that time, allowing for simple replacement of tribal casualties. Only this does not explain their common ages. And there is no mechanism to explain any such longevity. The best anti-aging drugs the hegemony has to offer only manage to extend an active lifetime a bit over the 100 standard year mark. Preventive health measures have spread the vitality of early middle age well into the late 60s, my age, but except for clonal transplants, bioengineering, and other perks for the very rich, no one in the world web can expect to begin planning a family when they are 70, or expect to dance at their 110th birthday party. If eating chalma roots or breathing the pure air of the Pinyin Plateau had a dramatic effect on retarding aging, it would be a sure bet that everyone on Hyperion would be living here munching chalma, that this planet would have had a Farcaster centuries ago, and that every citizen of the hegemony who has a universal card would be planning to spend vacations and retirement here. No. A more logical conclusion is that the Bakura live normal-length lives, have children at a normal rate, but kill them unless a replacement is required. They may practice abstinence or birth control other than slaughtering the newborn until the entire band reaches an age where new blood will soon be needed. A mass birthing time explains the apparent common age of the members of the tribe. But who teaches the young? What happens to the parents and other older people? Do the Bakura pass along the rudiments of their crude excuse for a culture and then allow their own deaths? Would this be a true death, the rubbing out of an entire generation? Do the 70 murder individuals at both ends of the bell-shaped age curve? This type of speculation is useless. I am beginning to get furious at my own lack of problem-solving skills. Let's form a strategy here and act on it, Paul. Get off your lazy Jesuit ass. Problem: how to tell the sexes apart. Solution: cajole or coerce a few of these poor devils into a medical exam. Find out what all the sex role mystery and nudity taboo is about. A society that depends upon years of rigid sexual abstinence for population control is consistent with my new theory. Problem: why are they so fanatical about maintaining the same 70 population that the lost dropship colony started with? Solution. Keep pestering them until you find out. Problem. Where are the children? Solution. Keep pressing and poking until you find out. Perhaps the evening excursion down the cliff is related to all of this. There may be a nursery there, or a pile of small bones. Problem. What is this belong to the cruciform and way of the cross business, if not a contorted vestige of the original colonists' religious belief? Solution. Find out by going to the source. Could their daily descent down the cliff be religious in nature? Problem. What is down the cliff face? Solution. Go down and see. Tomorrow, if their pattern holds true, all 70 of the 70 will wander into the woods for several hours of foraging. This time, I will not go with them. This time, I am going over the edge and down the cliff.